This is the IBJ Podcast for the week of January 20th, 2020. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. On January the 7th, the federal government filed a False Claims Act lawsuit against Community Health Network, the Indianapolis-based healthcare system that includes 8 hospitals and dozens of other care centers in central Indiana. This is a big deal, and a case that potentially could cost the system millions of dollars. What the feds essentially are claiming is this. Over a period of at least 9 years, Community engaged in a scheme to beef up the number of doctors employed by the network. And what it wanted from these doctors was referrals. It wanted these doctors to guide their patients to receive and pay for services within the Community network. And the government claims that to get these referrals, Community agreed to compensate at least some of these doctors far more than what the market would consider a reasonable rate. But when you're talking about patients who are insured by Medicaid and Medicare, the government says this is a violation of the Stark Law. The Stark Law was enacted by Congress in 1989, and it prohibits doctor referrals of patients covered by Medicaid or Medicare to hospitals and other facilities if the doctor might benefit financially, especially through the form of high salaries or bonuses. And these claims are especially noteworthy because they originated from a whistleblower lawsuit filed by Community's former chief financial officer. Now, the finances of healthcare are notoriously difficult to understand, and there's obviously a lot to unpack here. IBJ healthcare reporter John Russell has been covering this case closely. He has a story in the latest issue of IBJ about the Community case and how the Justice Department has been using the Stark Law nationwide to claw back government reimbursements and tack on huge fines. And he joins us now in the podcast studio to bring us up to speed. Thanks for making some time today, John.
Glad to be here.
So just slow walk me through this, if you would. Let's start with talking about referrals.
Sure.
Which most of us are familiar with.
Yes.
But just to clarify, what are referrals and why are they so important for hospitals?
So if you go to a doctor with a minor issue, an earache, a cold, the doctor's probably going to be able to take care of you right there and send you home, maybe with a prescription, and you don't need a referral. But many other cases are more complex. You go to a doctor with some unexplained pain in your arm or with some knee pains or some eye problems, he's going to have to refer you to a specialist or to a hospital or to a lab. And so there's a huge network of primary care and specialists and all these add-on services around your community. And it takes many, many, many different parts and pieces to give healthcare to a person over the course of their lifetimes.
Why are our hospitals so eager to have their doctors refer work back to the hospital?
Because that's where the hospitals get their business. Hospitals aren't retailers, usually. You go to a hospital because your doctor sends you there. You go to a hospital because a doctor admits you, or a doctor writes an order for you to go to the hospital and get a lab test or an x-ray. That's where hospitals get all their business. They don't go down the street with a cardboard sign trying to get admissions on their own. Doctors generate the vast majority of business for hospitals.
Here's an experience I've had before. I assume this is pretty usual. We've talked about it on the podcast before. I'm a cancer survivor, like a lot of folks. I like to get things checked out when I feel something weird happening. So a couple years ago, I'm having abdominal pain. I go to the same hospital system where I got the cancer care. They order a scan and they say, hey, the scan looks great, but we noticed there's a little something there in your lung. It's a little nodule, could be sarcoidosis. You should go see one of our pulmonologists. So I go to the pulmonologist and this pulmonologist says, hey, let's get in there and take that out. Let's schedule a procedure here at the hospital, which we do. And they take it out and everything's fine. But that sounds like a lot of referrals that all went to the same place.
That's a very common scenario you just outlined. And I too am a cancer survivor and I went through a similar chain of events all within one hospital system, from the primary care guy all the way to the lab, to the x-ray, to the urologist and to the oncologist. Hospitals like to keep it in the family. Hospitals don't want to lose a business. That's called leakage. They don't want doctors to be referring to other hospital systems or to other clinics. It's very intentionally designed that they have everything they will need under one roof or a couple of roofs so they can keep the business in-house.
Right. And that's not illegal on the face of it.
That is not illegal. It's only illegal if they're doing certain things that cross the line.
So what is the difference in the Community case? How is the government alleging that Community broke the law?
Government is alleging that Community paid way too much to hire doctors over a course of 8 years, gave them double, triple, even higher multiples of what a doctor would normally make to be hired, and incentives of the same kind, so they could bring them in-house under the community physicians network label, and then the doctors would refer all their cases to community facilities. In doing so, oftentimes the doctors can charge higher fees, charge at a hospital rate rather than a clinical rate, and that drives up the cost of healthcare. Now, all these are just allegations. Community says they've been cooperating. Community says they did not break any laws, and this is a very tough terrain. It's a very complicated kind of case, but that's what the government is saying.
So, to clarify what you just said, like if you have a certain procedure done in a facility like a hospital, they can charge the insurer a hospital rate as opposed to, like you say, a clinic. They would pay actually a different rate even though the same procedure is being done.
That's right.
And to have it in hospital, I assume, is what the hospital would want generally.
Yes, and that's just a reflection of a larger struggle that's been going on in healthcare for the last couple of decades, where payers, including private insurance companies and Medicaid and Medicare, have been pushing back very, very hard to try and get care provided at the least cost. So you're not going to the emergency room. You're not spending nights in a full-service acute care hospital. You can get minor stuff taken care of on an outpatient basis or in a clinic, in an urgent care center, which are often one-tenth the cost of what you're paying in a hospital.
Now, the reason why the government is involved here is because of the claims that were paid by Medicare or Medicaid. Is that right?
A lot of these claims were, yes. And this is a law called the Stark Law, which was originally set up to try and safeguard those programs and keep the government from overpaying.
Just to make sure I'm clear, as a doctor, what is the problem with me referring my patients to the hospital system that employs me? Sounds like that's not the problem. The problem is the fact that the hospital system might be paying me too much, an excessive amount or a bonus to do that. That is the distinction.
I think most people would say you want to get care at the most competitive price. You don't want to be paying 5 or 10 times what it would cost to get a procedure done at a hospital versus at a clinic down the road or a lab around the corner. As a doctor, you're perfectly free to refer patients to any site, but it should be competitive price and it should be good quality. So if you're referring to a place that doesn't meet those standards, that's going to be the problem.
I would assume that a lot of healthcare consumers wouldn't question what their doctor says. The doctor says, I'd like to refer you to so-and-so. I mean, unless you're a pretty well-educated consumer, you're not going to shop around.
You're not. That's starting to change a little bit, but it's generally true. And doctors still are the blonde-haired heroes of the healthcare system. You trust your doctor more than you trust your insurance company, more than you trust the pharmaceutical company, more than you trust the government. So, yes. Doctors have lots of power, and this law is intended to keep them and their health systems from using that power or abusing that power to drive up the cost of healthcare.
Now, within the community health system, I mean, they offer, I mean, a gamut of services, procedures. For folks who are maybe from Indianapolis, this is one of the major health and hospital systems in central Indiana. I think there are 8 hospitals.
They have 8 hospitals from Anderson all the way down to Johnson County, I believe.
Surgery centers, urgent care, outpatient facilities. Mm-hmm. I think more than 200 total care sites, is that right?
That's right. And that's not unusual. You'll see the other major health systems in Indiana. If you keep your eyes open and you're driving down almost any major road in town, you'll see a clinic or a lab or something else with a community or an Indiana University Health or a St. Vincent, this or that. They're everywhere.
And it employs now more than 350 physicians.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Which is about double what it was maybe 10 years ago?
It's double what it was 10 years ago, but it's still a pretty small number. For example, Indiana University Health has almost 2,000 physicians in-house, which is one of the largest networks in the country. Community became concerned, according to the lawsuit and the government, about 10 years ago or so. They were too small. They needed to grow to be competitive with these bigger health systems and with their insurance companies to have the power to keep those referrals in-house. So that's how they started growing, and that's got them to where they are now.
So what does the federal government want in this case? What is it asking for?
The lawsuit is very voluminous. It's more than 100 pages, and it has lots of facts and lots of allegations. It doesn't really say, though, what it really wants in terms of, here's how many times we say community and its physicians cross the line. Here are all the claims we're trying to get reimbursed. Those kinds of details will come out later. But what the law says it can ask for is triple damages and reimbursement of up to $22,000 per false claim and all the money back that was illegally paid. So you're looking at tens of millions of dollars potentially.
Oh, so there's a huge amount at stake here for community.
Yeah, and it's why community is fighting back. It's why a lot of other health systems have fought back too or have settled, because the numbers could climb even much higher if you try to litigate this and go to a jury. It could be 10 times this amount and has been. Some health systems have been socked with hundreds of millions of dollars in awards. So it's a big gamble for community and any other health system to try and fight it.
So we should say here that Community Health has declined to comment on this case because it's in litigation, beyond issuing a statement in which it denies the allegations and says it has complied with all laws and regulations. Just for their sake, I'm going to read what they sent us. So their statement was as follows. This lawsuit involves certain administrative issues that are completely unrelated to patient care. We are confident that we have complied with the laws and regulations that govern the way we operate our health network. We are committed to fighting these allegations, which have no merit. We are confident that we have complied with the law and regulations that govern the way we pay our physicians for the services they provide to our patients and to the communities we serve. Services such as teaching, research, providing education to patients, and developing protocols to enhance care delivery. Community recognizes that physician compensation is very complex and highly regulated. Our physician compensation practices are a key part of our overall compliance efforts. We are confident that we operate in a legally compliant manner. Did anything about that statement strike you?
Yeah, it's interesting that the very first thing they said was, this is not a patient care issue. They're very sensitive, and all health systems are, to patients misunderstanding what's going on and what's at stake. This doesn't involve bad patient care. You didn't operate on the wrong patient or on the wrong part of the body. There's nothing like that. Yeah. But the law was not set up to address those things. This law is set up to keep costs down and to remove conflicts of interest and incentives for patients and health systems from charging too much. That's the next point they made. And they say that that's an extremely murky and complicated field, which it is. And we're just going to have to wait to see how this plays out.
Now, one of the compelling things about this case, I think, is that it's based on a whistleblower complaint against Community by its former chief financial officer, Thomas Fisher.
It is. That is unusual. And I'm going to take partial credit for being the first reporter in town who recognized that that was at play here. Tom Fisher was their their chief financial officer for 8 years until he suddenly left the system in about 2013, I think November or December. And I've been wondering about the circumstances of his leaving off and on since then. I knew there had to be more to it. I didn't think this was going to be it. Being a whistleblower is serious. and he's not giving interviews, but I would love to hear his whole story.
How long did he serve as CFO?
For about 8 years.
And he has a separate lawsuit against Community. What is that about?
Well, whistleblower suits start out as privately filed lawsuits under a very specific portion of the law, section of the law, called Key Tam, which means that you've got the goods, you're an insider, and you've got the goods on something improper or illegal, and you want to bring it to light, file a civil lawsuit, and you're also inviting the government in to help you. The government takes a look at thousands of these Key Tam cases and gets involved in maybe 10 or 20% of them. They can still move ahead by themselves, but they're often more successful when the Justice Department jumps in with their full weight.
So in his separate lawsuit, is this right? It was about him being fired, right, in retaliation for asking questions about what he saw that appeared to be inflated salaries.
That's what he's saying, right. He said that he was fired as the last course of a long, difficult period during his last couple of years as CFO. This all happened during a very difficult time, a market downturn for health systems in Indiana, which were laying off thousands of people back in about 2010. Community, like most of the other health systems, was laying off nurses and cutting salaries and wages of cafeteria workers and therapists and nurses' aides. And according to Fisher's suit, he said, how come all these doctors are making these huge salaries and I'm having to cut the wages of these lowest paid workers? And he tried to get an explanation. He kept digging and kept asking his superiors why these doctors were walled off from this downsizing and from this cost cutting. He was charged with $100 million worth of cost cutting and revenue enhancement over 18 months.
Yeah, he was asked to
he was asked to do that, which was a directive from the board. And that was obviously the biggest pot of money on the table, and he wasn't allowed to touch it, he says. And he kept going back to it and asking why these people were protected and not getting a good answer. He says he asked one time too many and he was let go.
And he's the CFO, and he's saying that he wasn't involved, that he was in the dark of all this.
Well, he certainly saw all the numbers, and he saw who was getting paid what, and he saw the rest of their budget. I think he knew what was going on. He didn't know why everything was happening, but he saw what was happening. He claims he was punished for asking why. The other interesting thing about this suit is, you know, Fisher filed this suit back in 2014 after he was fired. This lawsuit has been under seal for like the last 5 years. And a lot of people have been whispering about it, have known about it. Community says they've been cooperating with the Justice Department for a long time, trying to respond to these claims. So it's finally just all come out into the light when these cases were filed and unsealed this week.
Here's one of the questions I had when I was reading these stories. Are the doctors who allegedly received this rich compensation from Community, are they in any way in danger of censure for this? Are they expected to pay some kind of price for this?
I'm not a lawyer. I've talked to several lawyers for this story to see who's got exposure, who's got civil and criminal liability. Doctors are prohibited under the Stark Law from referring these patients, but doctors, to my understanding, are very seldom prosecuted or named in civil complaints unless there's extreme behavior or unless there are explicit kickbacks involved.
If it's just a matter of like compensation, you still would think a doctor would have an idea of what his kind of fair market compensation would be, or he or she.
You would think so. I mean, a cardiologist who's making $300,000 one year and then is hired by a health system for twice that and overnight starts doubling his salary isn't going to complain. And if you look on a lot of websites, almost every government website that deals with healthcare and a lot of legal websites spell out a lot of warnings to doctors what you can and can't do with referrals and what you can and can't do with income. Doctors get a lot of training on this. It's not like they're completely ignorant of it.
Do we have reason to believe that this happens elsewhere in central Indiana hospital systems, that this was just an outlier case because they had such a good insider?
It certainly seems to be one of the most interesting and case with the strongest allegations. But lawyers tell me that just about every health system in Indiana, in every market, and in many other states, get hit with some kind of violation of the Stark Law. My story includes a couple of examples. For example, Indiana University Health was named in a whistleblower suit a couple of years ago, which just got settled for $18 million. Not exactly like this. Every suit is different. Almost every health system you can look up, Google your favorite local health system and Stark Law, and you're going to find some kind of allegation and usually some kind of settlement.
So what's next in this case? What are the possible outcomes?
Well, you're still waiting to see what Community is going to say for itself. Cases usually then go to the defendant filing a long response, usually denying line by line, paragraph by paragraph, every allegation. I haven't seen that response yet, and I don't know when it's coming. It could go to a jury trial if there's no settlement. Many, many of these are settled. So even though hospitals always say we did nothing wrong at the outset and claim all along the way we did nothing wrong and never admit any wrongdoing, they often settle these cases.
Well, let's wait for the next filing and then we'll see what happens.
Sure.
Thanks a lot, John. I appreciate it.
You bet. Nice talking with you.
My thanks again to John. You can check out his story on the Community lawsuit in this week's print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. And before you get on with the rest of your week, there are a few other stories I want to draw to your attention. Kurt Christian reports that the latest in the series of art installations in Carmel's roundabouts has reinvigorated debate over how the city buys and locates works for public places. As you might imagine, some installations are more popular than others, and one city councilor wants to create a community commission that includes residents who would review and make recommendations for pieces. The current process is ultimately controlled by Mayor Jim Brainerd. Also in this week's issue, Sam Quinn examines efforts by Indianapolis officials to address the potential effects of climate change on the city, as well as reduce the city's impact on the environment. And Lindsay Erdody has our latest annual tally of philanthropic giving in Indiana, an analysis of the big gifts, The winner this year was Indiana University with 3 of the 10 largest donations, and Lindsay has a deep dive into how IU and President Michael McRobbie made it happen. Again, you can find all these stories in the latest issue of IBJ, which you, of course, have delivered to your home or office, or online at IBJ.com. And remember, to have full and unfettered access to all of IBJ's award-winning business content, just hit the subscribe button. Thanks again, folks, for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King, and we'll be back again next week.